Hello, everyone, and welcome to Really Old Movies. I'm your host, Harrison Scullin, and today I got a very special guest, Chris Yogerst, the author of the new Warner Brothers book, and we'll be discussing that and kind of his process in putting that together. And yeah, let me give you a little introduction to who he is. Got a little bio here. He's the author of Hollywood Hates Hitler, Jew Baiting, Anti-Nazism, and the Senate Investigation into Warmongering in Motion Pictures, and From the Headlines to Hollywood, The Birth and Boom of Warner Brothers. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Los Angeles Review of Books, Journal of American Culture, Historical Journal of Film, Radio, and Television, and also The Hollywood Reporter. He currently serves as an associate professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So without further ado, let's introduce our special guest. How's it going?
Good.
Awesome. You got quite the bibliography there.
Yeah, a lot of stuff has come through in recent years.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I'm kind of noticing a pattern here, but what kind of is your main, your main focus when it comes to writing?
Yeah, the pattern really, I mean, it's interesting. When I started studying film, I was really interested in genre and how genre evolved. And the more I learned about that, the more I became interested in how movies operated within their time. And, you know, their social and political influence and things like that. And that's where it was kind of natural for me to be drawn to Warner Brothers, considering their movies are almost always, you know, these social and political documents, right, that, that mirror or engage in the time. So I'm increasingly interested in how not just movies, but almost all popular culture and how it engages with the issues of the day. So that's kind of a through line with all of my books. And a lot of times the kind of thing you mentioned, the Hollywood Reporter, I've been writing there more regularly since last fall. And the kind of stuff that I pitch there, it's almost always, you know, there's something going on now where it's there's a historical precedent or there is some kind of something we can learn from the past to inform the present.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really awesome. No, I love that because, you know, if we don't learn our history, we're doomed to repeat it, right?
Absolutely.
So, no, that's awesome. Well, now we can kind of start talking about the newest book you did, the Warner Brothers. And the first question I have is, what led you to writing a biography about the Warner Brothers?
So, I mean, I know I've told this story in a couple other podcasts, but I don't really have another version of it to keep it fresh. It's really just, I wanted to do Harry Warner. And because the more I learned about him, the more I was like, this guy, you know, needs his day. He needs a better platform because so many books, it's like Jack Warner is the Warner brother, right?
Right.
It's like, well,
right.
There were others.
Right? There's a couple more.
Right. I mean, unless you're really into silent cinema, we tend to forget about Sam, who died in 27. Albert avoided the press expertly. And Jack, you know, was always trying to get his names in the headlines. And Harry was so much different than all of his other brothers. So I wanted to write about him, but I met, I'd been wanting to meet Patrick McGilligan for years. He lives here in Milwaukee as well. He's written so many awesome books. I finally met him at a bookstore and he was asking about what I was doing. I was talking about Harry Warner and he pretty much said, you need to do all of the brothers. And let's have lunch and talk about it. So we did. And he is the series editor at Kentucky. And I realized, I'm like, well, if I can have somebody like him as a mentor to take on this now massive subject, right? You know, 100 years plus of history of all of these people.
Right.
I was like, I think I can do this well and retain my sanity by the end of it.
Right.
that's how it started. It was, I wanted to do Harry. And it's you know, it worked out well because we had the 100th this year. I was able to get it done by then of the Warner Brothers Incorporation. Of course, they had been operating within the movie world since 1905. But that's really where it all started.
Oh, that's awesome. And I got to say, I kind of agree with Kevin Brownlow where he says it sets out to be epic and it succeeds.
Kevin, he was a huge supporter of my last book. I knew somebody who knew him. I had never met him. I just sent him a digital copy. It was during the pandemic. He read it and emailed me back and we'd been in touch. And once I started working about the Warner Brothers, he ended up, I didn't even ask him. He just asked to look at the manuscript and he read it twice.
Wow.
Gave me all kinds of feedback and almost all, and I'm happy to say it was almost all just him going on at length about how he loved this part and that part and this part. And he was really useful because in the 20s, when I talk about 20s and 30s, really, when I talk about Sam's wife, Lena Basquette, mm-hmm. her book is, it's hard to describe. It's pretty wild. And you feel like you're reading like the most gossipy history where you feel like, I don't know if any of this is true. And I realized that Kevin had wrote an obituary of her when she died in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
And so I asked him, I was like, is she just full of crap or can I trust her? Or is she like, so I, luckily he said that she definitely has a flair for the dramatic, but as far as like facts go, he said, you can trust her. So that was really important for me because then I could actually utilize some of her stuff more effectively and not have to be as critical of it as we would like Jack Warner's memoir, which we know is mostly garbage.
Right.
But fun to read. I mean, we can get a lot of his personality from it. It's really useful for that. But as far as facts, a little trickier. So Kevin was absolutely fantastic in terms of not only giving me support when I needed it, but also just being, you know, a cheerleader for the next generation of historians. And I know I'm not the only one. I mean, anybody you mention, I mean, I was just out in LA for a couple of weeks. Anybody you mention in the archive film history world, you mention his name and it automatically gets a smile ear to ear. I mean, he's fabulous.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, someday I want to buy the Napoleon restoration he did.
Oh, for sure.
It's too expensive, though. It's like $100 on Amazon.
Right. Some of this stuff needs to get, you know, redistributed somewhere where we can all get it a little easier.
Yeah. All right. You kind of already answered this next one, but I'll ask you it anyway. Who else were you able to interview and talk with to learn more about the brothers?
So this was another one where Pat was really helpful because, you know, there's so much out there about the brothers. There's so much archived and there's a lot of stuff available. His argument was basically, you don't need to reach out to the family to discuss stuff. I reached out to Cass Warner, didn't hear anything back. I figured she's probably done with, I mean, she's been carrying the torch of that family history for decades.
Sure.
Since it came out, I've actually talked to Greg Orr a lot, Jack's grandson.
Oh, okay.
And so he's read the book. He really enjoyed it. We see the 1956 sale of the studio a little bit differently. He's been great to talk to. I mean, he just redid remastered and updated the documentary he did about Jack. And that just came out and he and I did a interview over Zoom, that discussion about Jack's legacy that's on that disc. But he's been, you know, it's been great to talk to him. He gave me a lot of stories that I think I will include in like a preface to the second, you know, not the second edition, but the paperback of this. And a lot of people have come out of the woodwork since the book came out that I talked to Saul Polito's grandson. He was a cinematographer at Warner Brothers. I've gotten emails from other people that I will be speaking with soon. But for research purposes, I didn't need a ton of, cause I mean, when you go far back, you know, back far enough, there's, you know, nobody's around.
Right. There's a point.
So, some of the stuff going back to the teens and even before that, I found a lot of great material that was actually archived in the studio files that they kept, which are a bunch of articles from a journalist in Pittsburgh where they originated with all their companies. Her name was Esther Hamilton. And she kind of took it upon herself to cover the rise of these like hometown heroes. So she talked a lot about, you know, them in the, you know, from 1905, pretty much to the early 20s.
That's really cool.
That we could get some people that were covering it in the moment, you know, before they were famous.
Right,
that was really helpful. But then a lot of it, I mean, just with either database access or other archives, there's so much print material available that hasn't been used in previous books, that there's just a wealth of stuff out there that I had no shortage of interviews and opinions about the Warner Brothers to use.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, something that's interesting now I think about it is, unlike the other studios, the Warner Brothers, it was like the family business. So this is like their ancestry, their history, basically. So
absolutely.
It's really cool that they had all that at your disposal. That's amazing.
Yeah, they were a family. It was kind of a tumultuous family relationship. But I mean, there was a lot, they learned so much from their parents. You know, the whole family was very close. I mean, Jack was kind of the outlier in a lot of ways. But you're right. I mean, it's very different than the other studios because, you know, and that's what, you know, that's why, you know, Daryl Zanuck probably, he was never explicit about it, but a lot of people agree. That's probably why he bounced, because he knew he wasn't a Warner. He wanted to run his own studio. So he knew he wasn't going to be the guy, at Warner Brothers.
Yeah. All right. Move on to the next question. What was the hardest part of putting the biography together?
Oh, man. Well, some of the early stuff is tricky just because so much written about the Warner Brothers starts in 1923. Some of it starts in 1918 when they do My 4 Years in Germany, and they have some success with that. So it was tricky writing pretty much like the turn of the century up to 1918, because most of that hasn't been written. There's no template. There's no like book to build from that has some of that. So you're pretty much starting from scratch in a lot of ways. So that was tricky because you're kind of blazing the trail there. The other part is, and this is also where Pat's advice was really, really helpful. You know, there are so many movies that Warner Brothers made. And when you get into the early 30s, I mean, there was one year I counted, I think it was like 80 movies.
Oh, wow. Used.
I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it's nothing like that today. And no. And very few years like that for other studios, even in the peak of the golden age. So there's so many movies to cover and so many iconic movies. So, you know, I had asked Pat, like, what do I do when I get to Casablanca? You know, where it's like this huge thing that, you know, anybody reading about the Warner Brothers and expects something about Casablanca. Mm-hmm. But his advice was really helpful in that you only need to talk about Casablanca as much as any of the brothers were involved, because they're the through line of this story, right? You know, that was another one of my motivating factors, where so many books about the Warner Brothers end up being about the movies and the stars and not about the brothers. And the brothers end up being like supporting characters in their own story. So I wanted to correct that and make sure that they were the main characters, and that all the other glitz and glamour of Hollywood and celebrity was a supporting character. So the hardest part was not going down the rabbit holes of every single movie that has an interesting story and deciding when to just reference other books and be like, here, this was written about. And, you know, Jack and Harry weren't as involved, so I'll move on to the next thing. So that was always tricky to do.
What I love, though, about what you did with the book is it kind of interwoves like historical events happening around them and how it affects the family. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine that was difficult, kind of deciding what to put in, what not to put in. And yeah. Right.
And in the historical rabbit holes, I allowed myself to go down a little bit because that's where I could add context to their lives, right? Mm-hmm. Here's what was going on in politics. You know, Harry was meeting with world leaders all the time and weighing in on world events in very public speeches. So it's like those were opportunities to flesh out the era a little bit more and add context to the movies and the lives. So yeah, that was also tricky because it's, you know, so many of these things, there could be, you know, its own chapter where I realized this should just be a few paragraphs and I need to keep the narrative moving. I mean, kind of like a good Warner Brothers movie, right? These punchy narratives that were, you know, tight and to the point. So I wanted to try to keep that in the back of my mind also while I was telling their own story.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. All right. You kind of answered this a little bit too, but how did you decide what to put in the book, what not to put in? And that could be photos too, all of that.
Yeah, photos. Well, photos are, it was kind of easy just because there's, with my last book, there's a lot of photos that I found in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. that I wanted to use, that like political cartoons from the New York Times and all that kind of stuff. And if you're not, you know, like Stephen King or somebody, like you're probably not going to get an email back from the New York Times, which I did not.
probably not.
there were some really awesome photos that I found that I'm like, I want the right. Can I, you know, publish this in my book? And heard nothing. So the best way to do it is to find material that is open access, which there's a lot of. The Media History Digital Library is full of stuff. The vast majority of the pictures in this book come from the Media History Digital Library. But there's also another hack, which is to just order old prints of pictures on eBay. And then you can just cite from author's collection, which I did.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
So like there's the one with Jack and Alfred Hitchcock. There's a really great one of Harry and Jack and Betty Davis smiling. Those are all just eBay citing author's collection. And apparently we can get away with it that way.
That's crazy. That's actually really cool.
So yeah, so I mean if you know, well, and then what you can do, because you can find so much through those two avenues. And then you can avoid trying to get the rights or to pay, you know, an arm and a leg through, you know, major, you know, these other databases and stuff. Then, I'm all for making it easy as possible and cost effective.
Sure. Yeah. All right. Well, that kind of leads to the next question. What was the process of getting University Press of Kentucky to publish the book?
A little easier because, like I said, I had met the series editor while he was promoting his Mel Brooks book. And he kind of took me under his wing and helped that process. But it still had to go out. You know, I still had to put together a proposal. It's still because the university press is a peer review process. They still send it out to other historians to review and give feedback. So if that's, you know, if two people weigh in and say, oh, this book sucks or this proposal sucks, they probably wouldn't, you know, the director of the press would probably just say, let's just pass. But fortunately, they really liked it. So then we moved on to the next stage of developing, you know, each chapter and going and doing the research and all that. And luckily, some of this stuff overlaps with previous book, but there were still a lot of things I wanted to do. Unfortunately, I took one more big deep dive in the archives in Los Angeles in summer of 2019. So once the pandemic hit, I had, you know, a bunch of material that I could continue working during lockdown. Otherwise, the book probably wouldn't be out now. the process was really just putting together the proposal, which is an overview and then a chapter, you know, at least it's always going to change by the time the book is done. But, you know, you give a chapter outline, how you think the book is going to be organized and what you think you'll be able to cover. And then a sample chapter. I'm trying to remember what I used. I might have even used bits and pieces from some of my other work just as samples. And then, you know, once they sign off on that, then you start, you know, actually writing the book.
That's really cool. And would you ever do a biography of this scale again now that you've done it?
Yes. Yeah. I'm actually working on, I just got back from a trip from Los Angeles, and I'm working on a book about James Cagney.
Oh, awesome.
So there's a lot of, it's going to be another like lengthy, I don't have to cover as many people, Jim is the through line here, just one. I also want to bring more of his family into the mix. I think doing this particular book and then also having the guidance I had from Pat really, like I said, I could get through it with my sanity intact, but also now I realize, you know, like I know how to do this now.
Right.
And
right.
I know how to, you know, focus on, you know, one piece at a time. You know, it can be a little bit nerve-wracking putting the proposal together because it's like, here's this big picture and it's hard to see the whole book, But once you get through that, you can really just focus on one chunk at a time or one year at a time. And really, that makes it a little less intimidating. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier to take on such a massive project and not overwhelm yourself. So I think that's something that was really good with this book. You know, I know how to do this now. You know, my other books were a little bit more focused on smaller chunks of time. So this is, you know, the most wide ranging thing I've ever done. But yeah, now that I've done it, I really enjoyed it and I want to keep doing it.
That's awesome. No. And, that James Cagney one you're talking about kind of reminds me a little bit of the Michael Curtiz book Alan K. Rohde did, where it's like his entire life and whatnot, and just focused on him. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that too. That's awesome.
Yeah. Alan's been great. Alan was a big supporter of this Warner Brothers book too. We hung out when we were in LA, he did the Larry Edmonds event with me, and we just did a podcast for the extras that I don't think is published yet, but it will be soon.
Oh, awesome. I love the extras.
Yep. Yeah, we did that. But yeah, Alan's book on Curtiz is probably a good template because it's just so definitive. And you know, that one's different because there really wasn't any books about Curtiz. With Cagney, right, similar to the Warners, what you have is not only the new research you found, but you also have all this other previously written stuff that you have to address, especially if it gets things wrong. Mm-hmm. Or you know, skips over things. So you know, that was one of the things with the Warner Brothers. I mean, like I mentioned, like Jack Warner's memoir, right? Like it's fun to read. It's not trustworthy at all. And he gets some things really wrong. But it's really fun and it's full of his personality and his flair. And, you know, some of the early stuff I have reason to believe a little bit more. I mean, things about growing up and things like that he doesn't really need to be printing a legend about. But yeah, there's always that trick of, you know, when there's previously written stuff that you have to be, you know, you kind of have to go back through it carefully and see what was what. And like I said, with Warner Brothers, I mean, you either got Jack's thing, or you have the other books that ultimately end up focusing on the stars or just on Jack. So you can also find, you know, what holes you want to fill, right? What gaps are there in the literature where, you think there's a story yet to tell.
That's really cool. Yeah. Seeing a need, filling a need, right?
Yep.
That's great. All right. The next question, what's your favorite movie from Warner Brothers?
Oh, that's an impossible question, which I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
There's, you know, and it's interesting because it's not, as much as I love something like Casablanca, it's generally not Casablanca. I mean, there's some really, really good deep cuts that I've really fell in love with studying Warner Brothers over the years. One of them, Alan and I were just talking about at Larry Edmonds, and we talked about more on our extras podcast, which is a movie called Underground. Vincent Sherman made it. And it's a really good anti-Nazi movie that came out right before Pearl Harbor. You know, I really love, I mean, one, I will say one movie that brought me to, of course, you ask a favorite movie, I'm going to give you several.
No, that's fine. You
know, one movie that brought me to Warner Brothers is The Public Enemy. Brought me to Warner Brothers, brought me to Cagney. You know, growing up, I loved Goodfellas. I listened to an interview of Martin Scorsese talking about growing up watching Cagney movies and Public Enemy. So I had to seek that out. And then from there on, it was just, I was all Warner Brothers all the time. So I definitely love that movie. But another one that's more of a deep cut that some people probably haven't seen is Showgirl in Hollywood from 1930, which is a really interesting movie about movie making. Mm. And it's a really interesting commentary on celebrity in 1930. And as a fun aside, this wasn't long after Harry bought the First National lot, which is where Warner Brothers is now in Burbank.
Oh, okay.
And in the background of the movie, you can see some of the sets and lots being built that are still there. Like they were just being, you know, in the background of Showgirl in Hollywood.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that's really cool. You know, some other ones some people probably haven't seen. There's another one called Storm Warning with Ronald Reagan that is a 1950s kind of Cold War political thriller that I think is really cool. And I think is just Warner Archive recently re-released it. So I think it's starting to get rediscovered now. But they have so many of these punchy political movies that are, you know, every bit as engaging and entertaining as something like The Public Enemy. Mm-hmm. But I think are still a perfect, you know, ripe for rediscovery.
No, that's awesome. I haven't heard of any of those other than The Public Enemy, so I got to check all of those out. So
you got stuff. Well, and another one, just to make it all the way up maybe to the late 50s, another one I absolutely love that I've had a lot of fun teaching is called The Face in the Crowd. With, God, now I'm blanking on all the cast. Andy Griffith.
A political
operator who gets famous, and he uses his celebrity ultimately just for his own gain. And it's a really dark movie, but it's a perfect Warner Brothers movie, and it has aged really well. Because like I said, I'll have students watch it now. And a lot of times it's like their first black and white movie. And they come away not only learning that, wow, old movies can be good, but also like relevant. And
they end
up writing papers for my class about this movie and draw all these through lines to right now. And it's incredible how some of these movies have aged so well. So,
yeah, no, that's great. A lot of their stories have that timeless feel to them that
for sure,
I think, really attract audiences forever. I mean, what's good is good, right? People will always enjoy it.
Right. And that's something we talk about a lot today. I mean, I've talked about a lot with the other week when I was in LA, I also did a talk at Book Soup with Sam Wasson, who's written some great books. And we've often talked about how, you know, that's one big difference between movies of the golden age of Hollywood and a lot of the stuff that's come out in the last few decades is that I don't know what's been timeless in the last few decades, right? Like everything seems to really be time stamped in a certain way. And I don't know. There's very few movies that I can think of that might, you know, that came out 10 years ago that we'll be talking about in 50 years. You know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, Warner Brothers was one of these studios that just had so many of those movies that have just stood the test of time.
Absolutely. And I love that on HBO Max, or I guess Max now, they have Turner Classic, where you can see all these movies now. So it's really cool.
Yeah, and I did mention Storm Warning. I think that one, it was earlier this year. It was on Max. And a few of these other ones were too. I don't know. Underground, probably not. Black Legion, I think, was. But yeah, they're getting easier to find.
Yeah, because I'm sure for a while it's been very, very difficult. I mean, lucky if you could find a VHS, right?
Right. You know, when I was working on my first book on Warner Brothers, a lot of this stuff, which was just Warner's in the 30s, a lot of this stuff wasn't even available on DVD. And I had a couple different friends in the film Twitter world that actually had them DVR'd and would burn them to a DVD and mail it to me.
Oh, wow.
And that was how I first saw Confessions of a Nazi Spy and all kinds of these movies.
Wow. That's dedication right there. That's awesome.
It is.
All right. I think I already know the answer to this, but I'll ask it anyway. Who's your favorite Warner brother?
Oh, yeah. It's tricky. I mean, the answer would probably be Harry, but that was already kind of the case going into the book. After writing the book, I will say that I have a much bigger appreciation for Sam as well. I mean, of course, we know Sam, you know, helping bring sound to market. But the more I learned about Sam as a person and how he operated in the family and the bridge he was able to maintain between Jack and Harry, I gained a lot more respect for him. And it also makes it that much more heartbreaking of a loss when he dies.
Right.
So definitely those two. But I mean, Harry is, you know, he was the reason I wrote the book.
Right. No, I think I'd have to agree with Harry. I don't know. It's just so cool to me that he's not like your typical Hollywood producer or whatever. He actually had it all. You know, he has a great family. You know, they stuck together. He has kids and all that. And then his brother Jack is the one who kind of went a little crazy and went all Hollywood, if you will.
Right. Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing about Harry, because he is like the antithesis of the studio bosses. You know, he's married to the same person his whole life. Wow. That like never, ever happens in Hollywood. But also the way that he, you know, all of his kids, all the interviews I could find about him, everybody just seemed to really adore him. I mean, there were certainly some tensions. I mean, right. I mean, he wasn't just that were the standard tensions of the day, you know, between the studio brass and the talent and the unions. Right. I mean, they would draw a hard line with a lot of that. Mm-hmm. But as far as being a person, Harry was incredibly respectable, and you know, it was really hard to find people who didn't like him. You know, Daryl Zanuck talks some trash, but that's just because he wanted to run the studio and he wasn't a Warner.
Right.
But you know, that didn't last real long. I mean, it was, you know, there are certain things that you just wouldn't see. I mean, the one story I love from the book is where Harry Cohn comes over to Harry Warner's house. Cohn is with his mistress, and Harry makes the kids go upstairs real quick because he doesn't want the kids to be a party to this, even though they wouldn't have any idea that that wasn't his wife.
Right.
Like, that whole thing would have went completely over their head, but he was so respectable to a fault that he was like, all right, let's just get the kids out of here. And that's a perfect Harry Warner story. Cause of course that would be something he would do.
All right. Well, those are all the questions I had for you. Why don't you kind of tell people where they could buy the book and where they could follow you on social media?
Well, the book is available on Amazon, of course. I know I've been told some Barnes & Nobles have, not around here, but some Barnes & Nobles like Florida apparently have it. But yeah, pretty much anywhere online. I mean, in LA, I know Book Soup has signed copies. I know Skylight Books they have one signed copy because I signed it when I was there. A couple other stores, you know, like that. I mean, it should be pretty easy to find in Southern California. But otherwise, online is pretty easy to get it. The University Press of Kentucky website has it. And then social media, Twitter at Chris Yogerst, Instagram and Facebook at C Yogerst. Easy to find, easy to follow. Website, chrisyogerst.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for coming on. This was a blast.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and I really, really love this book. I want to say I finished it, but I didn't. I got to right after the war ended, kind of in the era where the HUAC and all that started.
Oh, HUAC, yeah.
So, HUAC, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It gets dicey from there. Yeah, you'll like it.
But I love it. It's a great book. It's one of my favorites now. So thanks again.
Fantastic.
For sending it and for being on.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for watching and listening to today's episode. And make sure to follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Really Old Movies. And with that, this has been Really Old Movies. I'm your host, Harrison Scullin. This is my guest, Chris. Take care.